infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects, vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us.
H.G. Wells in 1898 via Orson Welles in 1938 makes three assumptions about extraterrestrial life. First, that it exists. Second, that it's a lot smarter than we are. And third, that it's not friendly. How do those assumptions compare with what people have been thinking about extraterrestrials for the past 2,000 years or so? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Since the time of Aristotle, many keen minds have grappled with the evidence for and against the existence of life on planets other than our own. And leaving aside the popular refrain, "Is there intelligent life on Earth?" let's see if we can find a pattern in what scientists and philosophers have been discovering and surmising over the centuries. Leading us on a fast-paced survey is Peter Sobel, honorary fellow in the history of science department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Great to be here. Thank you.
It seems as if every day just about there's something in the news about a new planet-like object, a new science fiction movie. We just can't seem to get enough of the idea that there might be some sort of life somewhere. How far back do we have to go to find that interest?
It goes way back if you're willing to look at minorities of thinkers. I think it only really becomes as popular as it is today around the 17th century. But even before that, you can find people who speculate about the likelihood that there's life in other places. It goes all the way back to before Aristotle. Actually, it goes back to the Greek atomists who are working in the 5th century BC, although their work was made popular by a 1st century BC writer named Lucretius. And his poem, which is actually a huge work on natural history and an explanation of how things happen in nature, called On the Nature of Things. And as an atomist, he believes that everything is made of atoms, not quite like the atoms we think of today, but little tiny chunks that can lock together in different ways, come apart, lock together in new ways to make the substances that appear to us. And if there's an infinite number of these things, Lucretius believed, they would form worlds all over the place, not just ours, but wherever there were atoms. And it would happen until all the atoms were used up. And since he believed there were an infinite number of atoms, that's going to take a while.
Did he speculate at all, or any of these early thinkers speculate about exactly what kind of life might be out there?
They all, at least the atomists, all assumed that it would be like it was here. I don't think they entertained that it would be hugely different. Although once you get later in history, there's some willingness to say things might be larger or smaller or something like another form of terrestrial life would be the predominant form of life on this other world. Kepler at one point proposes half in jest that some lunar inhabitants might be like snakes, that the snake form would be predominant there. I don't know why.
And if you look at sort of the whole couple thousand years of these people trying to figure out what kind of life might be out there, do you see trends or patterns, you know, as we go from sort of pre-Aristotle up to today? Do you see overall kind of, I don't know, philosophical ways of looking
at yeah. I sometimes think that, or I thought anyway, this remains to be worked out, whether there's some sort of oscillation between a belief in humans or the Earth being unique, the Earth being ordinary and maybe even sort of run-of-the-mill, and then maybe going back to that the Earth is unique again. And I think the more we learn about nature, the more rapidly this oscillation takes place. I think now, with the observations we're able to make and the way we're able to define planets around distant stars, I think the trend is going back toward that we may be at more average than we like to think.
Oh, no, a C+?
Yeah.
For everybody?
Yeah, we could have that gentleman C here on Earth.
You mean that as the universe expands in terms of what we're aware of, the distance that we're able to actually track, and more solar systems, more planets are found, that it's more likely scientifically that we would think that there might be life like ours or life of some sort somewhere else?
Yeah, I think so. It was thought even by people in the 17th century that all the stars could be suns and have planets around them. But as our observational capability increased and we saw that there were different types of stars, we realized that there might be stars that couldn't have planets or wouldn't have planets like ours. And then it started to look like we were really unusual. But now that we can look and see, actually detect planets going around stars, I think it's likely that there will be more data to calculate the likelihood of an Earth-like planet. In the 60s, there was an astronomer named Frank Drake who is famous for proposing what is now called the Drake equation, which is a way of calculating the likelihood of intelligent life in outer space. And many of those variables today are still beyond our grasp to accurately or with any real reason come up with a value for. But the one that we're getting a handle on now is the number of stars that have planets around them. And we have pretty hard data for that now.
Meanwhile, back in the Middle Ages, we have, Middle Ages and years following, by the time we get into the 17th century with Galileo, for example, we kind of run head on with theology, don't we, if we start speculating about other life forms on other worlds?
Well, in the Middle Ages, this funny thing happened where in the 13th century, for example, in the arts faculties, which are sort of the undergraduate schools of the medieval universities, the people who were – and Aristotle's books were the curriculum for those schools. The people that taught those classes believed that Aristotle correctly described the world that we lived in. And it got to the point where the theologians were becoming at the University of Paris, to begin with anyway, were becoming annoyed with these guys because it seemed to them that these arts masters who were teaching Aristotle were asserting that God had to have made this world. And so the Bishop of Paris condemned a few hundred propositions that were being bandied about the arts faculty. And one of them was that God could only have made one world. God could not have made many worlds. I think it's actually how it's worded. So there's this huge irony in the fact that they want God to have had the power to do this, even though they don't believe he did. But it led to medieval philosophers, some theologians and arts masters as well, wondering, well, if God did make many worlds, what would that be like? It was all speculation. It was all what they called in Latin secundum imaginationem, just thought experiments.
Back to Aristotle, though, before we get to the Middle Ages and they're reacting to him and so on. Mm-hmm. What did Aristotle exactly say then about other worlds, other life?
Aristotle, in the huge volume of his writing that we have, doesn't say much about it at all. It's pretty clear that he thinks living things are restricted to the earth because the terrestrial realm is made of the four elements for Aristotle, whereas the celestial realm is made of something else, that quintessence, that fifth stuff that isn't any of the four elements down here. But there's one passage where he talks about the likelihood of creatures on the moon and says that's where there might be creatures made of fire. The other elements can all be thought of as the bases for certain kinds of creatures. And so that's strange to begin with, that there's fire up in the celestial realm. And it's this remark made in passing, although he does say this bears discussion at some future point. If he ever came back to it, we don't have that book.
Is that because he was looking at the moon and saw that it looked funny, the craters and so on? I mean,
no, I think he was actually trying to balance out these proportions of, well, earth or earthy-like creatures that like worms and airy creatures and watery creatures, and then there's this fourth element, fire. Well, where would they live?
Okay.
I don't think it was the appearance of the moon, although that was of interest to many people.
Those who condemned the university for its idea that God could only have made one world, they were taking that from Aristotle then, the idea that in Aristotle that the world had to be a certain perfect way?
Yeah, the theologians pretty much adopted Aristotelian natural philosophy and believed that this was an accurate description of the world God had made. They objected to the limitation on God's absolute power that he would have had to do this. But they all believed that he did. There was a theologian in the 14th century named Nicole Orem who gave some arguments to show that really the earth could be rotating on its axis and the heavens could be stationary, the stars could be stationary, and it would still look the same to us. But we all know, of course, that the earth is stationary and the stars turn. He made similar sorts of claims about God is all-powerful. He could have made many worlds, but we all know he didn't. So they're at the brink of taking this last step and at least trying to figure out whether these other things have in fact been created. But they are very much tied to the Aristotelian world picture.
But by the time we are actually able to see planets with telescopes, does that fuel further speculation?
You mean planets in our system?
And actually satellites to those planets.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that by that time, the idea that we are mediocre in the sense that we're average has come a long way because Copernicus has proposed that we're orbiting the sun and so are all the other planets. And that claim that we are like – this, which completely destroys the celestial-terrestrial dichotomy that Aristotle had proposed and that had been around for 1,500, 1,600 years. When Galileo can see mountains on the moon – showing that the moon, which had always been this celestial object, is very terrestrial, that Jupiter has things orbiting around it just like the Earth does, that the planet Venus has phases, which pretty much shows that it's going around the sun. This does lend a lot of evidence to the mediocrity hypothesis, which is sometimes called the Copernican hypothesis, which pretty much says that in absence of any other data, it's a good idea for us to think of ourselves as average.
So what would Galileo have thought then about the existence of life beyond ours?
He probably would have liked the idea. There's one passage where he – it's not clear what he means. He seems to want to say, if people propose this, I disagree with it. But he's making the statement in the context of an argument with a fellow with whom he's arguing about the nature of sunspots. And – it's an argument that Galileo is claiming that he can't follow, and I don't blame him. I have it here someplace. Shall I read this?
Mm-hmm.
Galileo was involved in a debate about the nature of sunspots with a man named Christopher Scheiner, who kept his identity secret. He referred to himself as Apelles. And in Galileo's third letter on sunspots, he's writing to someone who communicates with Apelles for him, and he writes, "I agree with Apelles in regarding as false and damnable the view of those who would put inhabitants on Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, and the Moon, meaning by inhabitants animals like ours and men in particular. Moreover, I think I can prove this." And then it gets strange. He says, "If we could believe with any probability that there were living beings and vegetables on the Moon or any planet, different not only from terrestrial ones, but remote from our wildest imaginings, I should for my part neither affirm nor deny it, but should leave the decision to wiser men than I." So he's bailing out here. He says, "I should follow their determination, certain that they were better grounded in the argument which Apelles adopts here." And here's where he repeats the Apelles argument for us. Namely, that it would be absurd to put inhabitants on the moon and not on the sunspots. "I do not very well comprehend this deduction," Galileo says.
Neither do I.
No,
yeah,
you
I
lost
guess,
me.
Yeah,
lost
one
me.
Being much hotter than the other.
Yeah, I think there was a sense in which people thought that if there were going to be inhabitants on other worlds, then they would be in every other world. And inhabitants on the sun or in the sun is an idea that comes up again. So it looks absurd to us, and it certainly looked absurd to Galileo. And Apelles is using the absurdity of inhabitants on the sunspots to also make absurd the idea of inhabitants on the moon. And Galileo doesn't follow that. But I think it is interesting here that he doesn't want to come out and say, well, that there still could be inhabitants on the moon. But I think he's playing some joke on Apelles here.
Well, it is interesting that he says he doesn't want to either affirm or deny it. He's kind of equivalent.
Sounds very 21st century politics.
It does. Another astronomer that comes along after that would be Kepler. And I'm curious what, as he's making more precise observations of astronomy, what kind of thinking he adds to this funny mix.
Well, Kepler, as you know, is the one who has the observations of the orbit of Mars that were taken by Tycho, and Tycho is using very accurate unaided eye instruments, and Kepler finds out that the planets are going in ellipses. Kepler was very interested in a book written in antiquity by Plutarch on the face of the moon, and he himself wrote a book that really he wrote for his whole life. It was meant to be his sort of dissertation, but he didn't finish it, and he went back to it throughout his life, and it was finally published posthumously. And it's about a voyage to the moon. The idea there was that he thought he could explain Copernican astronomy better if he tried to show people what it would look like from someplace other than Earth. But, of course, this is the 17th century. You can't just say, imagine you're on the moon. Here's what things would look like. He has to cook up this whole voyage to the moon. And in fact, the voyage takes place by magical means. And I wonder whether this is why he never published it, because Kepler did have to spend some time defending his mother from the very dangerous charge of witchcraft. It sort of alarmed me to discover he had even written this into a story.
Wait a minute. So Kepler's mother was accused of witchcraft.
Oh, yes.
And he has meanwhile written a book imagining a voyage by magic, like on a magic carpet?
No, they just sort of wind up on the moon through some spell of some kind.
Could spell trouble for the family.
No doubt some Kepler scholar has gone into depth and looked at this.
One thing that intrigues me about this time frame, though, is that we start to see theologians weighing in on the question. They're certainly not washing their hands of it by any means.
Oh, no. And this is the sort of irony of the position, because a theologian could take one of two positions here. It could be asserted that Scripture says God made man in his image, and it could be asserted that Jesus died on the cross for the sins of humans. And it wouldn't make sense to say that Jesus had to go to these other places and die on a cross there too. But on the other hand, other theologians, and much later, mostly in the 17th and up to the 19th century, seemed to feel that a single world was an infringement on God's absolute power. And here's this all-powerful entity. Why would he just make one little place in this vast cosmos? He must have made many of them. This is sometimes referred to as the principle of plenitude, that if you have an all-powerful creator, he'll make every possible kind of thing. Even if you're not a theist, even if you believe just in nature, some theists, some naturalists would say that nature would make every possible kind of thing that nature could make. So it's not a contradiction for a theologian to say, oh, sure, there must be inhabitants on all the planets, and there must be planets going around the other stars. And in fact, the salvific effect of the crucifixion isn't necessarily an inverse squared force. I mean, it could happen once here on Earth and have efficacy all through the universe. Why should it be limited here?
It does raise that whole little psychological question for little old mankind, though, and that is, gee, you mean I'm not an only child?
Yeah. And that's a harsh lesson for some people.
Well, but you could see it either as a harsh lesson, lonely, you know, make it sort of an attack on your ego if you think there's another world.
Or the good news is you've got playmates.
Friends. I mean, less lonely in a very huge world. And even, you know, if you think of all the science fiction, the journeys to the moon, journeys to Mars, a lot of it seems to be wishful thinking that there'd be this discovery, that there'd be this amazing place you could go and find some.
Yeah, no doubt about it, that you could go to a place that would be better than this one. In fact, and in the 1950s, when UFOs were big here on Earth, there was a certain class of people called contactees who would claim not just that they had seen a UFO, but that they had talked to occupants of UFOs and maybe been taken for rides. And those people uniformly say that the aliens are benevolent, that they've come here to protect us from ourselves. They're always physically perfect, and their worlds are perfect. So, yeah, I think the wish for some better place or for some guidance is behind a lot of this.
Is there speculation as we get into the 17th, 18th century as to what these people, these extraterrestrials, are like in terms of intellect and temperament?
I think by and large they come across as very much like ourselves, except a little better. But there isn't any sort of wild speculation or wild belief about that they have tentacles or heads, things like that.
We do seem to go through these currents of thinking, especially later on, late 19th into the early 20th and 21st centuries, speculation that these extraterrestrials are pretty nasty folks.
Well, that does happen, yeah. I think that happens once we start flying around in our own air and use it to harm each other. I think that the whole picture of aliens does begin to change then, and you get that War of the Worlds, the clip that we opened with, which makes aliens out to be not benevolent at all. And that seems to be the – except for little movies like, what, E.T., there's a benevolent little alien.
Yes.
There are probably other ones where the alien is a good guy. But it's much more fun lately to think of them as being bad guys, because then we can fight back and be brave.
Back when you were talking about Kepler writing about the journey to the moon and so on, I mean, around the same time period, are there other imaginings of journeys to the moon and just ways of thinking about it?
Well, there are several books that are great fun to read from this period, and one of them is by Bishop Francis Godwin, who died in 1633. And his book, The Man in the Moon, was published posthumously in 1638. It may be strange how many of these things were published posthumously. It was very popular, 25 editions in all, described a journey to the moon by a man who was towed there by goose-like birds. When he got to the moon, he found out that the dark areas that we see from the Earth are actually land, and the bright areas are water, they're seas. The moon, as in folk belief, is quite moist, and that's okay for the beings that live there. They're all very beautiful, especially the women. They all know who Jesus Christ is, and they live in a very peaceful society. There's no murder, and if someone should accidentally get their head cut off, that can be healed. The dead, it would be interesting to know how they die.
And this is a bishop writing this.
Yes, this is a bishop.
Okay.
And again, I think he's enthusiastic about how much creation there could be, how much life there could be out there. He may also have just been having fun. And
one wonders.
This is why it was
posthumous. Or a little too much of that communion wine.
Yeah. And my favorite part of his book, though, is that this society, if they do have undesirables, they get rid of them by putting them on a high hill somewhere in North America.
That explains a lot, too.
Yeah. Somewhere in Texas, I think.
More on extraterrestrial life when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Peter Sobel, and he's enlightening us about thoughts over the centuries having to do with speculation about extraterrestrial life, and quite a rich and varied bunch of thinkers we've come across so far. As we get into the 17th century and we have people who in some cases are very rational and logical about this rather than taking a philosophical or theological approach. What do we find, for example, if we look at René Descartes?
Well, Descartes was a very influential philosopher, died in 1650, and he was quite anxious to get away from a lot of the what he thought was silly thinking in the Middle Ages. He wanted to reduce everything to impact. The only kind of causal agent there can be is one thing pushing on another. And he decided that our universe was made of solid matter, broken into little bits that can move around, and it was by now in its history segregated into little cells. Well, not little, of course, because we live in a huge one, but all of The universe is broken up into these cells, which contain matter that swirls around. And in our cell, it carries the planets around. So for Descartes, it would make perfect sense to propose that some of the other cells, some of these other vortexes, would have Earth-like planets and would have beings on them. He doesn't, to my knowledge, speculate about what they would be like, but they would probably be very much like us.
What about when Newton comes along with the laws of gravitation and just sort of the idea of even coming up with laws to explain motion? Does he think outside this universe?
It's interesting to mention Newton now because it's Newton's laws that showed that the Cartesian vortexes can't possibly work. And the people who were interested in this idea combed Newton's works and found very little about this. There's one line in the General Scholium to his masterpiece, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, where he sort of hints at, well, if the fixed stars are the centers of other like systems, then they were also formed by God. There's a mention in the Latin edition of his Queries, which is a bunch of questions he added on to the end of his Optics, which suggests that he did think that this was likely. But he put it in the Queries, and that was interesting. Newton was very careful not to put anything in the finished form of his work that he wasn't absolutely sure would follow from his first principles. So that this is in the Queries means something. And the only other references are unpublished bits and letters. So it's quite likely that he did believe that other worlds and other inhabitants were possible, but he wouldn't ever say that he knew it for a fact.
And as more planets are getting discovered as we move into the 18th century, does that change the thinking at all on extraterrestrial life?
I think it makes the idea more likely. Certainly the more planets there are, that's just more evidence either for the fecundity of nature or the creative genius of God and more possible homes for extraterrestrials. I can mention William Herschel here, who discovered the planet Uranus in 1781, and this was a big shock because, of course, nobody thought there were any planets out beyond Saturn. That was the furthest planet away that anybody knew about for hundreds of years. And Herschel, it turns out, believed that all the celestial bodies were inhabited, including the sun, and that the stars, the distant stars, were suns that had planets in their own right.
We think of the 19th century as another one of those eras of very articulate and influential theologians. If you combine that with this discovery of other things out there, other planet-like bodies out in the cosmos, what's the result?
Well, again, you get theologians who think that the discovery of new planets is just more celebration of God's creative power, and they're delighted to believe that there are inhabitants on these new planets. There are inhabitants in every possible place. There's an argument that goes way back to the Middle Ages, if not before, that says nature does nothing in vain. And that same argument could be applied to the creation of anything. I mean, why are there stars that are, by now we know, very far away? They don't really help us very much. I mean, it's not clear that they change much about our life here on Earth. So they must be there for something. Why would they be? They can't just be there for decoration.
Or by accident.
God does nothing in vain either. See, if you believe that nature really has its basis in God. So if there are all these planets, they must be there for a reason. They must have inhabitants. Even moons of planets like our own must have inhabitants. And perhaps even the asteroids. Maybe even comets. There was a Reverend Thomas Dick who died in the middle of the 19th century, wrote a book, one of several books actually, that talked about the possibility of extraterrestrial life. I think this was his earliest one, The Christian Philosopher, in 1823. And he asserts that there are inhabitants on all the planets, some of the asteroids, Saturn's rings, and maybe even the comets.
The 19th century was also time of wonderful hoaxes. Were there any involved with this this dialogue about extraterrestrials?
Yes, indeed. The son of William Herschel, an astronomer named John Herschel, had gone to the Cape of Good Hope with a telescope to view the things that you can see from the southern hemisphere that you can't see from the northern. And a newspaper in New York began publishing reports purported to come from some journal that actually didn't exist in Scotland, that John Herschel was sending his reports there. And they were detailed observations of the inhabitants of the moon and what they looked like and what they wore and how they behaved. And people just bought – I think it was the New York Sun. Oddly enough, yeah.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
Yeah. And other papers would copy the stuff without attribution, wanting people to believe that they had gotten the story too through their own sources. So the poor readers were thinking, wow, this all must be true. Look at all the different papers that are reporting it. And the reports ceased when there was a – I think the last one began to describe the sexual behavior of the lunar inhabitants. That was the end of that. And then the employee of the Sun who'd been writing all these things fessed up that he had been doing it. And apparently when Herschel down on the Cape of Good Hope found out about it, he laughed. He wasn't upset at all. So yeah, that was called the Moon Hoax and was famous and might have been responsible for Edgar Allan Poe writing his Adventure of Hans Fall, which some reports say he was going to write a second installment to, but the Moon Hoax
kind of short-circuited it.
Short-circuited it, yeah. Been beaten by a newspaper that was claiming to tell the truth.
Well, when Darwin comes along mid-19th century, and even before that with all kinds of geological discoveries and other things that are sort of leading up to evolution, what difference does that make to the thinking about extraterrestrial life? Because if you're now looking at the Galapagos Islands, for example, and looking at all sorts of animals and the way they evolve – does that change how you see what might happen on other planets?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think the problem there is that Darwin can tell you why living things branch out, but he doesn't know where living things originate. And you'd want to know that before you started talking about the likelihood that there were living things on other planets. Like today, when we look out, we are looking at places where we think the chemistry for the origin of life could have occurred. Like it might have happened on Mars long ago, although it's looking not so likely anymore. There's a moon around Jupiter called Europa that might have liquid water, which we think is crucial to that process. Once you've got that, then if Darwin is right, we might be able to speculate about what creatures in a given place would look like if they were to survive. If it's a hot place, we can assume that they've discovered ways of either getting out of the heat or radiating away heat or somehow making use of it in some way that maybe creatures don't here on Earth.
Have we found creatures on Earth that live in environments so hostile to most creatures, like, you know, the active volcanoes and very cold places? Have we found creatures that could live in corresponding environments on Mars or Venus?
Well, they're bacteria for the most part, yeah. There are bacteria that can live in very inhospitable environments, very hot places, acidic places. It's unlikely they could have arisen there. I mean, you can imagine that a hostile environment could be colonized by variants of a bacterium that actually began in some other
more mild,
hospitable place. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, the likelihood of multicellular life anywhere is still a point of raging controversy here on Earth. No one really knows how likely it is that once you've got cells, single-cell organisms, that they will decide to band together and become a little community, and that might be a very unusual occurrence.
The development of a more complex organism from single-cell organisms.
Yeah, a multicellular creature. That step is one that people are starting to take a look at, and no one really knows how likely it is. It's sort of strange because if in any creature like that, there are some cells that have very difficult jobs and end up not living very long. And so they're in effect sacrificing themselves for the good of this new whole thing. And how does that come about? It's very interesting.
We opened with a passage from War of the Worlds from 1898 is when it was written. And I'm curious with H.G. Wells' creation of that work of science fiction, what sorts of actual discoveries having to do with Mars and other things was he responding to?
Well, Mars had been, since the 17th century and the invention of telescopes, people are looking at Mars. And if you go and out on the web and Google, do a Google image search for Mars, you can put together this chain of drawings at first of what people are seeing when they point their telescope at Mars. And at first there's a disk with a blotch on it, and then there's a disk with a more interesting shaped blotch. And eventually you get images of Mars that show things that look like straight lines. And the famous one, the famous observation was made by Giovanni Schiaparelli. He drew a map in 1877. He had been using a telescope to look at Mars, and he described in Italian what he had seen as canali, which is the Italian word for channels, but that got translated as canals, and other people began looking up there and saw these straight lines too, and it looked for all the world like an artificial construction, not anything nature would have made.
Kind of like Venice or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Going from one polar ice cap to the other.
Well, sort of in a network. There was an American astronomer named Percival Lowell who was responsible.
The discoverer of
Pluto? Yeah.
For better or worse.
Yeah. He believed that these canals were really there. And this was in spite of the fact that there was some evidence showing that there was no water on Mars, no water vapor. And also, in spite of how difficult it is to make these observations, I've been talking to my friend Jim Lattice, who runs the UW Space Place, and he has described to me how difficult it is today. If you have an optical telescope down here on the ground and you're looking at Mars, you have to look long and hard because local atmospheric conditions can vary quite a bit, and as you're looking at Mars, it will change as the atmospheric conditions change. And you'll have a moment of clarity where things look really sharp and then they'll get blurry again. Maybe you get more damp air blowing by, something like that. So somebody like Schiaparelli or Lowell is sitting there looking at Mars through this telescope for a long stretches of time, hoping for one of these clear moments to occur where he can see what's really there. And you know, here's a guy who's already convinced that these things are there. We now know how easy it is, especially with optical things, to see what you expect to see. We now know that if you look under certain circumstances at images that are just dots, there's something about your optical apparatus in your brain that will create lines that connect them.
So, and hence canals on Mars.
Yeah, when you really get to look at them, they're just not there. I mean, now we have cameras on orbiting satellites taking pictures of Mars, and they're just not there.
Great fuel for H.G. Wells, though.
Oh, well, of course. Everybody believed at this time in the late 19th century that these things were very likely there in spite of all these party pooper scientists who say there's no water vapor on Mars. So what more instigation would you need to write a story about some creatures that maybe had built these and now needed to go somewhere else?
We're going to go somewhere else too in a moment. We're going to go into the 20th century for a fast look at 20th century speculations on extraterrestrial life when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Jimmy Carter saw a UFO, and more people in this country have seen UFOs than approve of George Bush's presidency. That's a comment by Dennis Kucinich in the November 07 presidential debate defending his remark that he had seen a UFO, which of course led to laughter. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Peter Sobel, and we're talking about extraterrestrial life over time, different beliefs. The comment in the November 2007 debate about seeing UFOs suggests that the discussion of this is still with us. And it was interesting because the person asking it said this is a serious question, but of course it generated laughter and lots of fodder for late night comedians. As you look not at our own century and time, but back at the 20th century as a whole, as we get increasingly sophisticated in terms of space travel, scientific information, computers, and all the rest of it. Overall, what do you see happening in the 20th century? Do we believe more or less in extraterrestrial life now or in the Middle Ages?
Gosh, That's a hard question to answer. I think if you look at the history of UFOs, and we could do a whole show just on that, it's fascinating to look back and see what people have thought things are that they see in the sky that are unusual. You go back to the Middle Ages, people will say they saw angels or God or something like that, and clearly they're seeing just unusual atmospheric phenomena. In the 19th century, people report seeing dirigibles flying around at great height or at great speed. And it's cute because people always see in the sky what they think can be seen there. And this is your brain working again, right? There's some bizarre thing up there. What could it possibly be? In the Middle Ages, it's an angel. In the 19th century, what can fly? It's a dirigible. In the 20th century, you start to have rocketry and the likelihood that outer space can be reached by rockets, with the consequent likelihood that things in rockets can come here. And so then the things we see in the sky become possible visitors from somewhere else.
And then by definition, they have superior intelligence because we haven't figured out how to get to where they are yet.
Yep, that's right. And their craft seem capable of doing things that we can't do. And they're saucers. We can't make a saucer fly.
And they seem to have either of two motives for coming over here. One is they've either screwed up their own world and are ready for some fresh territory like those Martians, or else they've come more recently to preach.
Yeah, the contactees that I mentioned earlier believe that they're here to – and that the contactee person himself will say that he was selected by the aliens to be their voice here on Earth, and he was to spread their message. And you wonder.
Which is a message about the dangers of
– of nuclear power
exactly,
usually,
technology of one form or another.
That's exactly right.
You talked before about with Copernicus and Galileo and various people and how – I guess it's sort of a concept of our place in the universe and whether we feel average or special. Mm-hmm. As we move into the 20th century, early 20th century, what sorts of key figures do you see who articulate our place?
That's an interesting question. I think once you get to Frank Drake in the 60s when he's doing his radio search for messages from extraterrestrial life, he's thinking that we're probably average. He's thinking he's pretty sure that once he aims that radio telescope at the sky, he's going to hear something, that they're doing this for the first time. If they had heard a signal, I don't think they would have been surprised. They would have been very excited. But I don't think they would have been very surprised. But at the beginning of the century, the attitude seemed to be going back toward the idea that we are special. We're learning more about the different types of stars, that there are stars that are not like our sun and that probably couldn't sustain life on planets around them. And let me talk at some length about Alfred Russel Wallace, who most people know as the co-discoverer of natural selection and who published the joint paper with Darwin. Darwin thought he was going to be scooped by Wallace, who sent him this paper from around the other side of the world with the same ideas that Darwin had been dragging his feet to publish. Wallace is a fascinating figure. He was interested in spiritualism. But he also seemed to believe that humans were unique. And it may have had some of the same roots in his mind that his belief in spiritualism had. And he wrote a paper in 1903 called Man's Place in the Universe, a study of the results of scientific research in relation to the unity or plurality of worlds. And that plurality of worlds is the phrase that was used to suggest that we are just average, that there are many, many worlds out there. And when I read this, I was quite struck by the disparity between these two groups of conclusions that he reaches. I'll read you what he, I think, correctly lists as the conclusions of modern astronomy. There's the first one, that the stellar universe forms one connected whole, and though of enormous extent, is yet finite, and its extent determinable. Well, gosh, gee, that's not – I don't think we can determine its extent. I mean, we do believe that there was a Big Bang and things are sort of moving away from other things, but whether it has an extent that we can determine, that's – they may have believed that then. I don't think we believe that now. But it is one connected whole. The second conclusion is that the solar system is situated in the plane of the Milky Way and not far removed from the center of that plane. The Earth is therefore nearly in the center of the stellar universe. Gosh, did I introduce this by saying these things are accepted. That's another one.
It does sound
not near the center. We don't even talk about a center anymore.
And what's the date of this?
1903?
1903. Okay.
Yeah. And the third one is that the universe consists throughout of the same kinds of matter and is subject to the same physical and chemical laws. Now, this is an interesting proposal because, of course, this is the Copernican principle of mediocrity. We have no reason to suppose that the laws of physics and chemistry are different far away, so we assume that they are, and that's why we say we know what distant stars are made of, because we look at their spectral lines and we assume that hydrogen has the same spectral lines out there that it does here. They might be redshifted a bit because it's moving away, but their relative position reveals what their source has been. So we know that that's hydrogen. There are some people who wonder whether this is the case, whether these laws might in some distant part of the universe actually be different, but that's just speculation. Gosh, so looking at this again, I'm not even sure whether other astronomers of the time would agree with this. And things are changing so quickly at this point that even if they did, it wouldn't have lasted very long. But the interesting thing is to see where Wallace went from these three conclusions, which seemed not to allow for much deduction about the place of humans in the universe. Here's what he says, his first highly probable conclusion, that there is no other planet in the solar system than our – that no other planet in the solar system than our Earth is inhabited or habitable. Well, that may be the case, but it doesn't follow from those first three rules. Two, that the probabilities are almost as great against any other sun possessing inhabited planets. Where on earth does that come from? Where not on earth does that come from? And thirdly, that the nearly central position of our sun is probably a permanent one and has been specially favorable, perhaps absolutely essential, to life development on the earth. I'm not even sure I know what that means. Central position of our sun in our galaxy? I mean, the sun is, of course, central to the solar system.
But it's considered now to be at the periphery, isn't it, of the galaxy?
Yes. In fact, our solar system is considered to be closer to the edge than to the center.
And what was Wallace worried about, do you think, in terms of if he let in the belief that there could be life elsewhere? Because he seems to be working hard there to conclude that it couldn't be.
Yeah.
What's he worried about?
He seems like the spiritualists that he was a member of. He wants humans still to have a special status. A lot of the drive around spiritualism at this time was the special place of humans had been threatened again. It was threatened by Copernicus, who made the Earth a planet. It's now threatened by Darwin, who makes humans just another product of a chance of just nature, natural laws working without any purpose.
But weren't the spiritualists also the ones who thought you could, like, levitate things and communicate through seances and all the rest of it, which implies this sort of other world dimension?
Yeah, but it was humans possessing this entity that could live in that other world, and humans were special. This was also behind the initial interest in ESP. I mean, J.B. Rhine, who starts the parapsychology lab at Duke, he wants to do this because he wants to show that humans have this capability that other creatures don't have. So Wallace, let me read you another bit from his paper. He believes that the emergence of humans can't have happened anywhere else, even in this huge universe. If it had happened, he says, and I quote, it would imply that to produce the living soul in the marvelous and glorious body of man, man with his faculties, his aspirations, his powers for good and evil, that this was an easy matter which could be brought about anywhere, in any world. It would imply that man is an animal and nothing more, is of no importance in the universe, needed no great preparations for his advent, only, perhaps, a second-rate demon and a third- or fourth-rate Earth. That says it all right there. I mean, this is a guy who is convinced that humans are special, and somehow it would detract from our status were we to discover other living things.
There have been an awful lot of discoveries since his time. Roughly 100 years worth of them, and it's a difficult thing to summarize, but how have they affected thinking about extraterrestrials?
Well, we know now that the universe is very much larger than Wallace or anyone at that point knew that it was. We even know that it might have an age. I mean, when Wallace was alive, as far as cosmologists knew, it had always been there. And in fact, when the idea that there had been a beginning to the universe, which we now refer to as the Big Bang, there was resistance to that idea from many people who didn't like the religious connotations.
The limitation.
Well, that it suggested that there may be something to the creation story in Genesis, and that offended them. So they said, well, the Big Bang can't be true, which was sort of an unfortunate tack to take. But the Big Bang predicted, or you could derive from this idea, that there would be a sort of background radiation. This was predicted in 1948, and it was actually detected in 1964. It's called the cosmic background radiation, and it's what's left over. There's a sort of 3 or 5 degree Kelvin radiation with some anomalies here and there that you can detect if you look for it. So that was a powerful confirmation of the Big Bang being the right idea. So the universe is huge and full of billions and billions, of, as Carl Sagan famously liked to say.
Dr. Sagan.
Yeah. So it strikes many people that the likelihood that we're it is ridiculous. I mean, this had to have happened in other places. But then you get into the realm of probabilities, and that is very difficult to work with. As I mentioned earlier, we're getting a better handle on what proportion of stars have planets around them, and we even know something about the planets. Some of them look like Jupiter. They're very large. As far as we know, they couldn't support life. But by looking at the way stars sort of wobble as they move along, we can calculate how massive a thing is going around them and sometimes even see them with telescopes. So we will get better and better at finding planets like Earth around other stars.
And maybe somebody out there is getting better at finding us.
Yeah, that's the scary thing, isn't it?
Well, we'll hope so during pledge drives anyway. Peter Sobel has been our guest through the galaxies and ages. Peter, thank you.
Thank you, too. Always a pleasure.
Can't resist this one quotation that you provided. Either we are alone or else we share the universe with creatures with whom we might one day communicate. Either way, it is a staggering thought.
Yes, indeed.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.